Cameron Sinclair was only 23 when he founded Architecture for Humanity, a nonprofit charity that puts architects and designers on the front lines of disaster relief. In the 7 years it's been around, Architecture for Humanity has responded to hurricanes Ivan, Emily, and Katrina, worked on reconstruction in India and Sri Lanka after the tsunami, cleared mines and built playgrounds in the Balkans, and designed refugee housing in Afghanistan. Through all of this, Cameron Sinclair's message to the design community has been simple. Design like you give a damn. He told Steve Paulson he's learned a lot since he first set out to build homes for refugees from Kosovo.
This was the first project that we tackled. This was back in 1999. And we looked at the idea that while many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, were looking at refugees as they were streaming out of the country, we really thought about, well, what happens once they return?
And often returning to places where they no longer have homes.
Yeah. I mean, this was a time when we were starting to learn about ethnic cleansing and the scorched earth approach, which was you go in and you kill a family and you turn on the gas and you blow up their home. You eradicate any memory of that family. Now, what we had come up with was a design competition where you would develop a sustainable transitional shelter, a shelter that would last 5 to 10 years, that a family would have on their existing plot of land, and they would live there whilst they rebuilt their own home. So this wasn't about giving replacement housing. This was giving a family the opportunity to rebuild their homes. This idea came directly from the refugees who said, listen, I know how to build. My family's been building for generations. I don't want some tent. I want to be able to just have that opportunity. And that's something that we've been working with for a long time, which is the idea of changing the policy. I can build a beautiful building that's low cost, but if I can't change the policy, then that's only one building. If you can change the policy, you can literally change the lives of millions of people.
So to be effective, you've got to work with the political system.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've been quite fortunate, at least overseas. If there's a disaster, I call it the Google effect. If you go to Google and you put in disaster and architecture or humanitarian design, we're at the top of Google, right? I don't know how it happened, but we are. So, you know, I'll be in the greengrocers, you know, buying asparagus and my cell phone will go off. And it's a cabinet minister of a country that's just been devastated. And they say, we were just on Google. We found your website. Can you help us? You know, which is a really kind of interesting, kind of takes you back a little that you can be in the midst of doing your daily chores and you have a world leader asking you for help. Internationally, we've had a lot of support. Nationally, it's a little harder. There's a lot more red tape in this country.
In the United States.
Yes. I mean, more politicians were former lawyers. So, you know, we live in a world of litigation. So to get to that level where you can talk seriously about housing issues, you have to jump through all these hoops. And I'm sure if there's any community members out there, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you're dealing in a country that's just been devastated, and the need has become so great. You know, when I was in Sri Lanka, within 2 days I was sitting in the Prime Minister's office. Here, you know, it's hard to get a meeting with the mayor.
Now, we were talking earlier about refugee camps and, of course, refugees. I mean, this is an enormous problem around the world. Mm-hmm. I've heard that you've worked on compostable tent cities.
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, we're doing a project in the next year called Rethinking Tent City. 1 in 7 people live in what we call slum settlements. That's inadequate housing, refugee situations, internally displaced populations. In 25 years, it's going to be 1 in 3 people. Okay, so we're not living in a world where housing is getting better. It's going to get remarkably worse. And that the city of the future is not going to look like New York City. It's going to look like Mumbai with illegal housing everywhere. So it's become really important for us to look at this kind of tent city situation. And we've had designers from around the world come up with these crazy ideas, one of them including a housing design that's impregnated with seeds, essentially, and that you live in this shelter until you can return. And you know, pack up this shelter and then you bury it underground and your first crops of the harvest come up. Now, it seems crazy, right? It seems like a crazy idea. But if the house is deteriorating at the same time, you have this instant first aid kit. And rather than your first aid kit being a Mars bar, you actually have crops. So you can actually harvest.
Now, I've also heard about something that just sounds totally remarkable to me. And I mean, some of these places, we have been war zones, and they have all kinds of landmines mm-hmm. around. I mean, of course, if you step on those, you get blown up. Mm-hmm. And apparently, you can plant flowers, wildflowers, that will detect the presence of landmines?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a Copenhagen-based company that has been looking at, they've genetically modified a plant. Now, I don't like genetically modified plants, but when I heard about this, I was like, this is pretty neat. This plant, essentially, when you sow the seeds, it becomes stressed and changes color because of chemicals. And the chemicals and the gases emitted from the landmines actually make it turn red. So you can essentially plant a field, and wherever there's red, you know there's a landmine. The other project that I really love is called the Mine Wolf, which is a turnip farmer in Germany said, well, landmines are just like turnips. So he built a machine that was supposed to be used for harvesting turnips. And he essentially made it strong enough that it could withstand the blast of a landmine. And this thing just rolls over a field and picks up all these landmines and just, you know, blows them all up and gets rid of them. So actually, for me, the landmine is one of the biggest issues globally, because if you have three landmines and you stick them on an acre of land and a child steps on one, nobody will build on that land, no matter if there's two or 200 landmines, because the psychological issues associated with that are disastrous. I'm not sure what you do. I think the best thing you can do is support the demining activities that are going on around the world. The one that I really love as well is, I think it's called like Mines to Vines, which is a California-based organization that remove landmines and put in grapevines, and then they create wineries. I think it's fantastic. You know, this couple who created this essentially have created this baby industry, this small industry of wine growers around Afghanistan, you know. I'll drink Afghani wine if it helped remove landmines. So I think it's been really fascinating, some of the, you know, ideas that have cropped up out of this issue.
This is fascinating to hear sort of the ingenious ways that design can make our lives better, especially for the people who need it the most.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what you'll find if you're out in the field is the community is some of the most inventive, creative people I've ever met in my life. I mean, some of the most amazing products and buildings that have been designed and developed have happened out of developing nations. A good example of this is in South Africa, we're currently doing something that on the outlook looks like a very simple project, which is building a soccer field, right? This soccer field is more than a soccer field. It's an area which has the highest HIV/AIDS rate in the world. And the community came to us and they said, look, we have an issue. Is that none of the young girls in our community are neither educated nor do they meet with each other and can discuss these issues. So by the time they get to the age where, you know, they get into their teens, they all get infected. And this is why, you know, this problem is getting worse and worse. We need somewhere where girls could meet. They can talk about their issues, and perhaps we can introduce healthcare. So we came up with this idea of doing a soccer field, and the soccer field is going to be run by HIV/AIDS trained nurses. They're going to be the coaches of the girls' team.
So you actually have both a healthcare facility there as well as the soccer field.
But it doesn't say healthcare facility. This is a great thing, is to break that taboo of AIDS and to really approach a community, young girls who have not been really approached before. You have to do it very softly. So we're using sports facilities as a way to do that.
So how do you make a soccer field attractive so that these girls want to go and hang out there?
You know, it's extremely easy. We put up a notice on the side of a road that said, who wants to join a soccer league? Within a couple of weeks, we had over 300 people sign up. So just the idea of having that facility within the community is extremely important. Secondly, you know, the design that is being built in South Africa is a beautiful, actually, construction that utilizes, again, local technology. It's going to be built by the community. You can go to our website and see the design. It uses landscape terraces and has awnings and a beautiful clubhouse. And, you know, essentially any football team or soccer team in the West would be extremely happy if it was their venue. But, you know, here you have 9 to 14-year-old girls who have a field of their own. They actually called the field Siathemba, which is Zulu for hope, which I thought was very nice. So this is really this is really how design makes a difference. These aren't just, you know, our projects. There are designers throughout the country that are involved in this, and they're kind of the grassroots hidden side of design. You know, there's Brian Bell in North Carolina who has something called Design Corps. There's the Rural Studio, which was Sambo Mockby, and there's Red Feather that works on the Indian Reservation. There's, you know, for every Frank Gehry, there are 100 designers in your community doing amazing work that don't want to be on the front cover of magazines.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I guess my image of, you know, young architecture students who go to school is they do want to become the next Frank Gehry. They want to put up the next fantastic art museum somewhere. But I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. But you're saying there's this whole other cadre of designers and architects who want to go out and make the world better.
You know, if you go to any design school in the country and you ask people, why did you become an architect? Okay, the top three reasons are, I want to design something that looks beautiful, right? I want to do something that helps the environment. I want to do something that really fits in the community. Okay, so you take those top three things. I want to help the environment, I want to do something in the community, and I want to do something beautiful. Right there is humanitarian design. I mean, when you go home and you watch CNN or Fox or whatever you decide to watch, and you see kind of this war and starvation and, you know, things like Darfur and tsunami, and you begin to think to yourself, well, wait a minute, all I do, if you strip away all the hype and everything, all I do is provide shelter. So why wouldn't I provide shelter to those who need it most? And this is a question that thousands of designers have asked themselves, and they've emailed us and said, can we do something? So we're just trying to act as that conduit.
Cameron Sinclair is the founder and executive director of Architecture for Humanity. He spoke with Steve Paulson.